The Athletic.
Ladies and gentlemen, it is showtime. Please welcome the team of the Fulhamish podcast.
It's the Fulhamish podcast, your independent voice of Fulham FC. My name's Sammy James and welcome to the show brought to you by The Athletic UK. And of course, today we're going to be previewing Friday's massive match between Fulham and Bournemouth at Craven Cottage. And of course, the talk is all around one man. The narrative centres around him, who switched allegiances for pastures greener. Of course, that is Peter Rutzler, who left for Bournemouth to Fulham two seasons ago. There's going to be chance for him on both sides of the ground. Some positive, maybe some negative. Who knows? And the great man is here on the podcast today. He can spare us 5 minutes out of his busy schedule. Peter Rutzler, hello.
Hello. I was just thinking about this. I feel like if you become the story, that's not right. Although I'm not sure if that's like a press officer thing. You know, like in the thick of it, where you know, once Malcolm Tucker becomes a story, he's gone. This is becoming a bit like that, isn't it? It's becoming a bit much. But anyway, hello, Sammy.
And Jack Collins, hello.
Hello, Sammy. Hello, Peter. Hello, listeners. How are we?
Fine, thank you. I just, of course, Scott Parker really is the man where the narrative centres around, even though we like to pretend that it's Peter. A massive game on Friday. First versus second. Old manager against new. I mean, it was no shock that this one was picked for telly and the big, big championship game of the season so far. So we're going to preview that. We'll do a final word on Preston from the weekend as well. And I've got a stack full of emails as well. I am loving the emails that come in for this show, as do Jack, as does Peter. So we're going to read some of those out at the end. So before we kind of get on to the Bournemouth game and everything around that, let's just discuss Preston on Saturday. Peter, it was a really, really difficult afternoon. In so many ways, obviously the result was difficult, the refereeing was diabolical at times, and just even getting to Preston sounded like a nightmare. So how was it for you?
Yeah, a difficult day all told. I think you've summed it up quite nicely there, Sammy. I did feel for a lot of Fulham fans trying to make it up on the day. I was quite lucky with my train. I got in okay. I mean, there were a couple of stops while, you know, the snow just sort of swirled around the train and you thought, well, is this going to happen? But obviously, that sort of careered and made it a lot more difficult. So fair play to everyone who set out and also to those who got there as well. It was a tough task. And to be honest, the performance wasn't exactly thrilling, not by Fulham standards this year either. And I just felt like one of those they had to get through in the end. I mean, the first 20 minutes were great. It looked like things were going swimmingly. Felt like the team might run away with it. Another good day out. But then it just felt like fatigue, didn't it? I think that was the overriding feeling for me anyway. It was an odd one. And I think I wrote about this after the game because Silva had talked up the fact that, you know, obviously there's a sharp turnaround and the EFL should be protecting players more with a schedule, but then didn't make any changes, which felt like an odd thing to do. And I can get it. I can get the fact that, you know, if you're in the starting 11, you earned the shirt, you keep your place. And that's quite an important thing to maintain within the squad, and he doesn't like to mix things up. But at the same time, Fulham have a very good squad and they probably should maybe use it a bit more. And you know, with the cushion they got to the playoffs, did they really need to risk some of those players who were coming back from illness and whatever else? But you know, still emerged with a point despite that shocking refereeing decision. Last time we had one of them was Coventry and it didn't end so well. So you take the positives, take a nice gap before the big one on Friday.
Yeah, I mean, people talk about refereeing decisions coming around and going around. And whilst I do broadly think that's true, it does feel this season like we are very much on the receiving end. I would say 3-1. If I think about the goal for Bristol City, the Coventry penalty, and then that goal on Saturday, maybe the West Brom penalty can be the one that I think has gone for us this season. So it definitely feels like we're owed a slice of luck. We've definitely had a few decisions go against us this year. I mean, Jack, it's as you were at the top of the table. Apart from the fact that actually QPR are now in third, they've leapfrogged West Brom. Finally, West Brom have had some sort of penance for their terrible form. Yep. Bournemouth drew with Coventry with one of the flukiest equalisers you've ever seen from Todd Kane. But we were all very, very excited on the Fulhamish WhatsApp when that one came through.
Yeah, it felt like it.
We've got away with one, really. But also, last nine games, even though you've had those two draws, we're still on 2.5 points a game. You said it, weeks ago, we need 2 points a game between now and the end of the season, and we are promoted most likely as champions.
Yeah, I think so. I think 2 points, well, I think 2 points per game is enough to get you up automatically, perhaps not as champions if the pace continues at this kind of frenetic rate. But I also think that we're seeing a little bit with Bournemouth at the moment, that kind of drop off that I was expecting. That's not to say by any stretch of the imagination they're not a good side, because they are, and they need to be given due respect. But I do think that we're seeing them regress a little bit to the mean. And I think actually where you look at the Fulham results, you're thinking, oh, we were a little bit unlucky, obviously, against Preston with the decision, not in terms of the performance, but in terms of the decision that went against us, which was the big turning point, right? That is the game that stops you being in, the goal that stops you being in the lead and stops you winning the game, given exactly what happened afterwards. And against Derby, where I thought we just, you know, lacked a little bit, but we weren't miles off there either. So I actually think we, with the last two games of Fulham, we've kind of created a fair bit against Derby. And in the Preston game, we were denied by an incorrect decision. So when you look at those two things in comparison to actually, yes, that fluky equaliser from Coventry was a bit lucky and absolutely spot on. But in Bournemouth's last couple of games, I think we started to see them regress a little bit to perhaps slightly more how I expected them to, you know, play this season, and also to pick up the kind of amount of points that they were expecting to get this season. So that's a good thing. If we get back up to, you know, where we're at and stay above 2 points a game, I think Fulham going to be all right.
I mean, Peter, it's hard to tell from the telly, but did it just look like some of the players were out on their feet? Mitrovic felt particularly sluggish. It just feels like Marcus Silva tried to go with his first 11 in order to maybe win the game early and then hopefully rest. And it just very much didn't have much fruition other than the first 20 minutes, really. I think maybe they jaded quicker than Silva would have expected.
Yeah, because that first 20 minutes was, you know, typical Fulham, the Fulham we've seen in a lot of games this year, where they were just camped in the Preston half. They were turning the ball over time and time again. Every time Preston were trying to come out, they were pinned back in a five. I mean, it was pretty comfortable. Got the breakthrough, which was through a set piece, which has happened quite a few times this season. You know, when there is that block, it's the one thing that Fulham can also throw in. And I think that's such a massive asset, is just being able to just take a goal from a set play. Another brilliant ball in from Jean-Michel Seri, and a very rare goal from Tim Ream. But it did just feel like they faded. It was one of those things where it wasn't a case of they didn't look like they were trying. It was just they were a foot behind Preston. I think once Preston, you know, there were a couple of refereeing decisions actually that really got the crowd up, and that also did help them. But they were winning the 50-50s. They were winning the second balls. The second pass for Fulham, the second and third pass was always slightly off. It was always on the wrong foot of the teammate. And it just felt like by the time they'd won the ball back, they were exhausted, which is not something we're used to with a silver Fulham team. So in the end, that sort of did for them. And Preston, with their tails up, were very good, actually. They were very good at pinning Fulham back. And they didn't create too many clear opportunities, but, you know, they forced their luck, and obviously the decision denied Fulham probably the 3 points. But I think visually they did look tired and or fatigued, or just that sort of after effect, and that had a big impact for sure.
I mean, Jack, just on the refereeing decision, what part of it did you think was the biggest?
I can't believe you're asking me this. I know what you're trying to say. And I mean, look, you got.
What was the biggest wrong?
What was the biggest wrong? Was it the handball? Was it the offside? Well, which of the handballs to begin with? Was it the offside? Was it the foul on the
keeper?
Push
on Marek Rodak. Yeah.
I mean, look, we just got to chalk it down as a decision that they got wrong. And
no, you can't cop out. You've got to pick one.
One was the worst decision.
What was the worst offence? What was the offence of the, what, five or six or.
I think for me, probably the offside, because the rest of it, you actually can go, okay, there's a bit of pinball in the box. Yes, it probably rules it out in terms of a handball, but the offside's the one that people should be able to spot, right? That's a ricochet and an offside. And so that one's the one for me. I think that if I was going to give you an answer, but I do think we just, you know, have those decisions. And also, especially when everything's up, the crowd are up, et cetera, as Peter says here, you know, the referee is more likely to give a decision in favor of the home crowd. That's, you know, that happens. It happens everywhere. It's kind of natural. And without anything to check it, you're always going to look at it and go, unfortunately, that's the case. And, you know, I suppose we should probably say that Preston, you know, were decent value for a point. That's the key element here, right? It's not that, you know, I said at the start, they didn't create loads. They didn't create loads of clear-cut opportunities. They didn't cut Fulham apart, but we weren't great. And I think sometimes you look at that and go, you know, should Fulham have won because the goal that was scored shouldn't have counted? Yes. Were Preston value for a point? Also, yes. That's okay.
Anyway, no point crying over spilt milk. We'll move on and we'll take a break, and afterwards we'll preview Bournemouth on Friday. This is an advertisement for BetterHelp, a portal for finding online therapy. How's your social battery right now? If you feel a bit drained or lacking enthusiasm to meet all the social commitments in your life, then that can be a totally normal thing, especially with things picking up as we head out of winter. I know that pretty frequently a weekend just doing a few chores and watching the football was about the limit of my energy resources, but therapy can be a place to help you gain the self-awareness to build a social life that doesn't drain your batteries. Contrary to popular belief, therapy isn't just for those who have experienced major trauma. The overall goal is to empower you to be the best version of yourself. And if therapy is something you've considered, then why not give BetterHelp a try? BetterHelp is entirely online and designed to be convenient, flexible, and suited to your schedule. They'll match you with a UK mental health professional with a wide variety of expertise. There's no referral needed, and you can switch therapists at any time for no additional charge, giving you complete control over the whole experience. Fulhamish listeners get 10% off their first month at betterhelp.com/fulhamish. That's betterhelp.com/fulhamish. Part two of the Fulhamish podcast, Sammy James here with Jack Collins.
Hello, listeners.
And man of the moment, Peter Rutzler.
Hello.
Peter is on the Fulham website doing an interview, if you want to read it, if you head to fulhamfc.com. It's a fantastic article, kind of giving Peter's opinion on both sides. You're going to be on the Bournemouth website as well, Peter, later this week?
Yeah, rumour has it, end of the week, some will say. So.
Nice. Yes. And of course, in The Athletic, Peter has done a very, very long read. It's fantastic. It's called Mitrovic, Seri, Cabano, Shunned by Parker, Starring for Silva in Fulham's Promotion Push. And it's looking ahead to Friday, the narrative around Parker, what has changed since the summer, the turbulence in the summer. And it's a fantastic read. If you want to go read it, it's on The Athletic app right now. Go to theathletic.com/Fulham pod if you would like to sign up. Jack, you said in the break that you had something to read. I don't know what this is. I feel a little bit out of control, but the floor is yours, my friend.
Well, we got a brilliant DM about a month ago from TJ, who's at TJFoggs46, who basically said, can we call the Bournemouth match the Spider-Man game because it's the Peter Parker derby?
Very good.
Very good. I wanted Excellent. To give it the due credit that it deserved because I thought it was very good at the time. It's taken me ages to find it again as well because obviously it's like a month ago in the DMs. But I thought it was I thought it was worthwhile finding because it was good.
I love that you sat on it for all that time as well. Just exceptional. He's just known the day he wants to drop it in. Peter, look, it is a game that is very much circling both of your interests. We know that you covered Bournemouth for the season that they went down. And even since then, you've still been kind of a bit around Bournemouth and covering what they've done for the past year or so. It's a remarkable how many narratives this game has. Parker obviously at the center of it, and two clubs who are having brilliant seasons but have gone about it in different ways. There's different philosophies right from the top all the way down. What do you make then of Friday's game and its significance?
It's quite unusual to have a game with so much narrative like this. It's, you know, hard to sort of ignore. Nothing to do with me, I think we should park that, but in terms of the fact that Scott Parker has gone there, the fact that both teams are a cut above so far this season in the Championship, and as you say, Sammy, they're doing things in different ways, both in terms of style of play and also how the clubs are structured and their stories. It's a very interesting one. I think if we start with style of play, like, I think I'm tempted to say attack v defence, which isn't strictly true, because yeah, Fulham have been very good defensively, and that's probably been one of the more unexpected sides of what Silva's been able to do this year. But in a more general sense, the way Bournemouth play, and Fulham fans will be familiar with this, the way they try and grip games, hold them, control them, squeeze the life out of them, that's that's Parker's way of playing. But he seems to have been able to do it in a far more effective way so far on the South Coast. And then, of course, we've talked about Fulham endlessly in terms of the amount of goals they're scoring, their ability to be ruthless, the fact they have no sympathy when they play opponents. You know, a one-goal margin, two-goal margin's good, but we're just going to keep going. We're just going to keep scoring 3-4 because that's who we are. That's how we play. And it is all set up so nicely, and it's going to be a great night under the lights. It's sold out at Craven Cottage. Both teams have had a slight wobble. Bournemouth more than Fulham. Obviously, it's hard to say Fulham had a wobble if you're 9 unbeaten. But Bournemouth have suffered with injuries, particularly at the back, and that's been quite important in their most recent games. So it'll be very interesting to see who they have available for that. Scott Parker, I went to his presser today in Bournemouth. He was very coy about all the team news, and I suppose you would be if it's 2 days before the actual game. So it's going to be very fascinating to see how the two teams set up and just what the game means as well. Does this mean more to Fulham? Do Fulham need to win? Do the players need to win to be like, look, this is how good we can be, to show Scott Parker what he's missing? And then on the flip side, is it Scott Parker going, look what I can do somewhere else in a different setup, doing things the way that I prefer to do them? So there's so much overlap, and it's not one I've been waiting for a while.
Yeah. Jack, do you think that the Scott Parker factor will actually have an impact on the players? I mean, it was telling when Parker left that there was so few, if any, thanks Gaffer, thanks for the memories, Gaffer. I think reading between the lines, he wasn't popular in that dressing room anymore. He's definitely not popular alongside Alexander Mitrovic. The fans really want to get one over Scott Parker. Do you think the players do?
Well, you'd definitely hope so, wouldn't you? It's a bit like anything in life, right? If someone you feel has wronged you or done you a little bit dirty or given you more of a hard time you deserved or not given you your fair share of chances or attributions, you want to prove them wrong, right? In any walk of life. And I imagine that, you know, part of this is all season long, right? It's over the course of the season, Fulham will want to finish above Bournemouth because they'll want to finish above Scott Parker and be like, ha, you were wrong. Could have done this with the squad and we could have scored more. And do I think that that's part of Alexander Mitrovic's insane goal scoring form? Yeah, I do. Yeah. I think he's out with a point to prove, and there's lots left in that to say it. Do I think that that can go one of two ways? Also, yes, right? There's a bit where sometimes with a football match, you're just trying a bit too hard, and, you know, sometimes you just got to relax and let it come to you. And we know that Fulham have the capacity to score goals, to entertain, to be fun and influential. And look, Bo Morte said it this week, didn't he? He came out and said, it's the show. People come to see the show. They don't, you know, they're not here just to grind out 1-0s or whatever. It's about putting on a performance. And that's what we've seen from Fulham across the course of this year. Now, Scott Parker clearly thinks of football in a little bit of a different manner to that. And that's fine, right? There is more than one way to skin a cat. But on the whole, you look at what this is and what it means, and you've got to be thinking for players like Mitrovic, for players like Cabano, for players like Seri. As Peter said in his article this week, this means just that wee bit more, just to be like, hey, mate, you were wrong. You were so wrong about us. And we're proving it by not only coming out on top of you in the league. And obviously, there's a kind of spice in that if Bournemouth were to win this game, they go back above Fulham. And there's that element of it as well. So, you know, it's not only going, okay, we're making a statement here, a blowout win against your nearest rival is a massive statement in what the division is. But also, there's this kind of separate run at the same time where you're looking at it and going, okay, we want to get one over and also increase that lead and prove a point in all the ways that we possibly can. I just am a little bit concerned about the fire and, you know, the kind of build up in the dressing room and what it means, and it just all maybe getting a bit emotional and a bit much.
Yeah. What's the feeling in the Bournemouth camp, Peter? Obviously, you said you were there today. Are they as determined as us? Is this a little bit more of a one-way rivalry? Obviously, Bournemouth are going to want to go there and win the match, and Bournemouth fans are going to be up for it. Who wouldn't be up for a top-of-the-table game on a Friday night? But it does just feel like Fulham fans have that slight more determination to right some wrongs, whereas for Bournemouth, I guess it's a little bit like, it's just a big game. I don't know. Or is there an extra sense of the significance because of the back and forth between the two clubs?
I think the game matters from a Bournemouth perspective more because of the run of form they're on, as opposed to everything else that's swirling around it. I think if you're Scott Parker, you want to play this down as much as possible. You don't want those distractions, because if you take in those distractions, it becomes about him and not the game itself. We got a sense of that today. You know, he spoke, you know, he said he had fond memories of his time at Fulham. You know, he hopes that he'll be remembered for the good things that he did there, both as a player and a coach. Didn't want to get drawn on the Mitrovic-Solanke thing, if you think back to that comment earlier in the season where he said that he didn't think that there was a better striker in the Championship than Solanke.
What did he say to that?
He just said they're two very good strikers. And that was that on that front.
That feels like one of those classic responses you get on Football Manager, click the button that says they're both very good strikers and they've both got their own talents.
It would have been done better if you just clicked storm out. That would have been the moment for me.
That would have been very, very odd. So from that side, yeah, I think it's a big game. As I said, their form hasn't been good. It's 6-4 without a win now for them. They're aware of the challenge that Fulham pose. And I think from Fulham's side, maybe it matters more, and understandably so. But you know, as we were just saying, you know, this does matter. Like, clearly it does. You know, Parker's left Fulham to go to Bournemouth because he thinks he's got a better chance of building a long-term vision, building a club, having more say. He said today, I asked him about that, and he said, you know, he feels like he's had that. He's probably been able to put his stamp on the club a bit more than he did at Fulham. So, you know, trying to almost prove a point, that's going to be there. But I think fundamentally, it's a game with two teams at the top of the table, and what matters is arresting their form and trying to put themselves in as commanding a position as possible in that hunt for promotion.
Jack, obviously Bournemouth, as Peter mentioned, have an injury crisis. They also have lost Jefferson Lerma, who got sent off against Coventry. Seems to be in defence where they've got most problems. Jefferson Lerma was playing centre-back on Saturday. Gary Cahill's injured. Kelly is also injured. There is rumours that Cahill might be back for the game, but it might be too soon. That's a big problem if one of those three can't make it back. That's a big gap at centre-back. And of course, probably the one position on the pitch where they'd like to have their first strength players, given the form of Mitrovic.
Yeah, exactly right. There's a couple of things going on there, and I'm sure that, you know, they're keeping it close to their chest because they're desperate to kind of come up with a late fitness test and get one of those players on the pitch in order to try and combat. You know, when you've got a striker in this kind of form playing against a manager who wants to prove a point to, the one thing you really want going on there is you having your first choice centre backs fit, and that's probably a point that they're looking at and going, oh god. But you know, ultimately you have to work with what you've got. Right, if it's a Championship, everyone's going to have little crisis, you know, like little crises in the middle of it here and there, you know, across the course of the season. Theirs is unfortunate in that it's come up against us, but you know, we might be looking at this in 6 months time, 5 months time, and going, oh, this is a terrible time when we've got to play them in the reverse fixture. So, you know, it happens, goes around, comes around, etc, etc. We're all going to have these moments, and I'm sure they'll just be looking at it and going, we've got to do the best we can with the squad we've got.
Yeah, Peter, what kind of impact is the injury crisis having on Bournemouth? I mean, there's still plenty of great players in this team. For me, picking up Ryan Christie the way they did was a fantastic signing. We know that Billing's a good player. Jaden Anthony on the kind of left back, left wing, has been a real revelation for them. But Jefferson Lerma, to me, most teams have like a key, right? One player in your team that you really... And for us, maybe that season feels like Seri. I don't know. There's arguments to that. Losing Jefferson Lerma feels massive.
Yeah, he's an absolute shithouse. And to lose him is massive. He's been massive for Bournemouth since they signed him. He's one of those players, I think, he obviously went through that period where he just picked up so many yellow cards, like just relentless numbers of cards. Obviously, it's caught up with him. But he was playing in defence for that game. And as much as Lerma's been important, I actually think the key loss has probably been Lloyd Kelly at centre-half. Now, Lloyd Kelly was signed from Bristol City. He's a player that's been looked at by some big clubs, and I think he's going to go quite a long way. Like, he's one of the best young centre-halves in the division. He's got a really high ceiling. He's very good at playing out from the back, and he's become very important in the way Bournemouth build their attacks. And both he and Gary Cahill have complemented each other nicely, and they've lost both, I think.
It's going to be interesting because, I mean, we saw that change of shape, right, against Coventry for the first time. Now, it's not helped by Lerma getting sent off, obviously, but that's the first, you know, time we've seen Parker really stray from a four at the back this season, right? And that's interesting because it leaves him with questions, especially if there's not those players coming back and now Lerma out, how you fill those gaps, especially if you're running short on defenders in the first place. I'd think that Parker might have fancied going three at the back for this game to try and deal with Fulham's threat in there. And he'll have seen, because he is a manager that studies opposition, that Fulham have slightly struggled against teams that do play in that kind of shape. So I'm a bit kind of there with, oh, is this one of those where, you know, he looks at this and thinks, I'd actually like to play three at the back, but I can't because I physically don't have the personnel.
Yeah, it'll be very, very interesting to see what he goes with. I'd have this sneaky feeling one of the three is going to be back. One of them's going to pass a late fitness test. They're going to do it by hook, by crook, injections or whatever. There's no way I feel like that none of those three play.
We know from last year and before with Parker with team news, it's just, you know, it's just almost irrelevant what he says, you know, unless it's long term.
Yeah, exactly.
Or you've seen them in it on crutches or something.
Jack, but Bournemouth going forward, I wanted to get your thoughts on Ryan Christie. I feel like he was an outstanding bit of business from Bournemouth. A fantastic player, one that I would love to have at Fulham. He seems to light up the pitch whenever he's on it. He seems so dangerous on and off the ball. Obviously, he was magnificent as well for Scotland in some of their recent World Cup qualifiers. To me, from the outside, he seems like the obvious threat, apart from, I know that Solanke's got the goals, right? But to me, it all seems about Ryan Christie, and he's certainly the man who creates the most chances for Bournemouth.
Yeah, he's a wonderful footballer, right? And he was excellent at Celtic before this. And as you say, you know, often very, very influential for Scotland. And look, I think you only need to go back, what, a year and a half or so when Arsenal were being linked with him in the January window and then in the summer following that as well. So this is a player who was linked with some of the, you know, bigger teams in the Premier League. It's not one of those that's obviously worked out for him because he's ended up at Bournemouth, and that's no slight. It's just there's a slight difference between those where he thinks, I think, maybe he should have been and where he is now. And he will look to be launching back into the Premier League as quickly as possible, because I don't think if Bournemouth don't go up, we're going to see Ryan Christie there next year. I think he's a player with ambitions to kick on and play at the Premier League level and to really move on. So yeah, I think he's the danger man. Obviously, as you say, Dominic Solanke's got the goals, and I've been really, really impressed with Jaden Anthony down the left-hand side as well. But on the whole, there's a lot going on here, and you have to look at Christie as that threat. I'm really intrigued. I think he'll obviously play off Solanke. He was given that free role in the game against Coventry, and if they do go with three at the back, and if they do go with two up top, I'd imagine he's going to be just given that kind of roaming role. And I'm intrigued as to who from Fulham decides that they're going to be the person to sit on him, because he does need to be tracked if he's just going to be given the freedom of the park.
I think one of the interesting things about Bournemouth this year is, as Jack says, has been Jaden Anthony and also Jordan Zamora on that left hand side. I think When Parker took over, you looked at the squad because they were losing Arnaud Danjuma. He was going to go, and he went to Villarreal, and you can see, you know, it's a Champions League level player. To fill that void is one thing, but then to actually do it with a player that's come through in a Category 3 academy, their weekly opposition is not that great. I watched him and Andrew Zamora a couple of times when I was covering the club. They look very good. They've always looked very good. But to actually take them, put them into the first team, and for them to actually kick on in the way they have, I mean, Zamora has been excellent. He's injured at the moment. Whether he'll be available, I'm not sure. But both he and Anthony have done superbly well. And that's actually been one of the things probably that was quite unexpected, I think, from a Parker side. I know he has blooded some young players at Fulham, Carvalho, Rodak. But to do so at Bournemouth from the start, and they have been a key part of how they've played in the Championship. And that's been pretty impressive. And he'll be a threat for sure on that left if he's playing there.
And Peter, just as someone that's been in and around Bournemouth, what is the kind of model there? Why were they so keen to get Scott Parker? And you broke it last season, but you said several times on several podcasts last season, and this was at times where Fulham were looking good in the Premier League, that Bournemouth wanted Parker, and Bournemouth had wanted Parker the season before, but he got us promoted. You knew that there was always that interest, and it wasn't a massive secret. What is it that they're trying to build there, and that they see Scott Parker as this man that only he can save them?
I think they they wanted someone to do what Eddie Howe was doing, but potentially not with the same overarching manager, I've got my hands in every pie sort of a approach, because Eddie Howe built the club. So I've said this before, it was his club. Like, he did everything, or if anything was happening, he wanted to know about it. They wanted someone who could fit into a model where they wouldn't be spending a lot. They wouldn't be punching above their weight. They would have a manager who would coach players, build them, improve them, and then sell them on, try and follow that up. Because that's what Bournemouth were trying to do in the Premier League. You look at the players they brought in, you know, David Brooks and Dan Juma, I mentioned before, Jack Stacey, Chris Meppham, Philip Billing was young when he signed him. That these are players that they all seem to have a resale value further down the line. And they wanted something like that. And I think Parker, they saw as a young British coach who was playing what they saw as quite attractive style of play, quite consistent philosophy, a philosophy that they could, you know, use throughout their age groups and help them to build on that front. And like, you know, you're right. I mean, the first time it was mentioned to me was before the playoff final, before Fulham Brentford, Scott Parker was mentioned, which was just after Eddie Howe left. But Scott Parker, and it was an odd one because, like, well, he's not going to go, especially if Fulham go up. But, you know, they stayed true to that, and they wanted him to oversee that project. And that's sort of been where they're at. And it's become more important, actually, since they didn't get promotion last year, because once those parachute payments start declining, you've really got to get your recruitment right. You've really got to build upwards, just like Brentford have done, to get into the Premier League. And it's that sort of way of approaching things, that sort of modern coaching approach, which is who they saw in Parker.
Yeah. I mean, in lots of ways, Jack, I hear what Bournemouth are trying to build, and I can imagine being that office, Scott Parker, and Bournemouth selling him the dream and telling him all this stuff. And in some ways, I don't envy him the decision that he took. Do I agree with the way he went about it, trying to kind of play the two off each other? Absolutely not. But in lots of ways, and look, there's lots of things I like about Fulham. There's some things I don't. We do seem a little bit batshit mental sometimes in the way that we undergo transfers and recruitment, especially. I'm not saying it doesn't work, but it's a pretty crazy way that we do things. And that Parker would have sat down in that room and gone, a bit more of a long-term commitment, a club that's really trying to do things the right way, a nice place to live. I fully see the reason that he went.
Yeah, I mean, look, I don't think anyone can be like, oh, why would Scott Parker do that? Especially with, you know, the amount of, look, there was a fair amount of grumbling right at the end of the last season. Put ourselves chief among that, you know, with the way that Fulham were playing, with the way that Fulham refused to attack at some points when we needed points. You know, there were questions being asked, legitimate questions, I'll put it out there, but still questions being asked of Parker's style, his management philosophy, whether he could do things, you know, differently, you know, all of these things, right? And that makes it difficult. I mean, imagine he can hear that noise, you know, he hears the what's being said about how he's playing. And there's also in so many ways, obviously he'll get an easier, and I don't mean an easy, but an easier ride from the press in the country because he's a young English manager trying to make his mark. And I'm not talking about Peter here, but like, you know, he's
giving
got
you
friends,
the eyes, mate.
He's got friends in the media. He'll have players he played with looking after him. And look, it's come into focus recently with Ole Gunnar Solskjaer, right? Players defending him despite the fact that the position was at some points indefendable. It felt like Parker got away with last year scot-free, and no one was really criticising him apart from the Fulham fan base. So sometimes there is an element of, do you start to believe your own hype? Do you start to believe the fact that you're like, yeah, I am a really good young English manager in this game who's working really hard, and the Fulham fans don't seem to want me and they don't deserve me? You know, those type of questions being chucked around, right? They are things that you can think about. Now, I don't think any of the criticism, or some, okay, I don't think that all of the criticism was unfair. I think that there was a reasonable amount of legitimate criticism about how Parker's tenure ended, and I think there's plenty of legitimate criticism about the way that, as you said, he played the two clubs off each other to try and get whatever he wanted out of that situation. But you're absolutely right. I can see why you can go into a club and they can sell you a dream and go, right, here you are, you can pick the players. Yes, the transfer budget is smaller, but you get complete control of it, etc., etc., etc. And I can see why that would appeal to him. But I can also suggest suggest that, you know, Fulham were looking at getting rid of him for a reason. And that reason was that they didn't think he was the person to recreate the style or the feel-good atmosphere around the place in order to get Fulham back up again. Two things could be right. Like, one man's trash is another man's treasure, right? There are things here. And look, he seems to be doing a very good job with Bournemouth in a squad that some people looked at and thought this might struggle. And you can give him credit for that without saying that he was the right man to take Fulham forward.
I think it's worth saying with the summer, as much as Parker can get criticism for the way it dragged out and the fact that it did compromise Fulham, Fulham also benefited from this ultimately, because they outwardly they wanted to keep him. 2 years left on his contract, would not have been sacked. But it did suit them for Parker to move on, because as we mentioned before, there were players that weren't used in the Premier League that were not exactly happy. And it would have been a very tough task for Parker to pick those players up. And I think he would have clocked that. And that's probably why Bournemouth seems so appealing. But then also, if you're Fulham, you're thinking, okay, maybe we should work on that. And for me, when my understanding of the whole thing was based on you can't just resign and go to Bournemouth without Fulham being paid compensation. It doesn't work like that. And ultimately, they did pay compensation. I think Fulham did benefit from that. But Jack's right in terms of, you know, what he is as a coach and what was appealing. And I my stance on Scott Parker is, and everyone knows because I say it all the time in terms of whenever we discuss it, but the way he left leaves a sour taste. There's no doubt about that. And if he does get a bad reception on Friday night, that's understandable. Yeah. That's what's going to happen if you leave in those circumstances after relegation like that, where it outwardly seems to fuck the club want to keep you. There's not been... You see the situation where he's clear, looks like he's angling for a move somewhere else. Doesn't look good. I still think overall last year he did a pretty decent job. And I know it comes across as, oh, he's getting defended again.
By his mates in the media.
But they failed last year. Like, there's no getting away from it. I'm not saying he did a good job because they failed. They should have stayed up. With that squad, They definitely should have said, look where those players are now. Anguissa is tearing up at Napoli. Lookman's at Leicester, Firmino's at Nice. Like, that squad was good enough to stay in the Premier League, and it should have done. But overall, you can see why a club like Bournemouth would want to pick up Parker, by the way they changed their style, by the fact that most elements of their game were enough generally to win if they used a goal scorer. And the most inexplicable thing was what happened with Mitrovic. The assumption was probably they didn't fit the style of play, but the one thing that sent them down was that they didn't take chances. Like, Fulham created more chances than Tottenham did last year. So it's one of those things. But, you know, it's done. And I think Bournemouth have got the coach they wanted. And I think Fulham have actually come out of it in a really good position as well, because they've got a coach who's been able to lift some of these players to heights that they weren't able to reach with Parker's style of play. And there's no doubt that the football that Silva plays is far more exciting.
Yeah, and that's what I wanted to come on to next, Peter, because that was more of the angle, actually, of your piece, was the difference that Silva's made at Fulham. Obviously, yes, it was slightly centred around what happened with Scott Parker. It was important for the context of the piece, but actually, you digged more into what Silva's done with this team in terms of increasing their attacking output. And some of the stats that you found in every single department attacking-wise, this is a better team, not only than last year, that's not too hard, but even 2 years ago, where we were all right going forward, and the numbers that this team are pulling in under Silva are streets ahead of where we were 2 years ago going forward.
Yeah, they are. I mean, the interesting thing is, both Fulham and Parker played a sort of a 4-3-3, but with the difference, and they were both sort of played build-up play, both quite... relatively structured in terms of what they do. Parker far more structured than what Silva is, and that's where I'd say there's a difference. But Fulham are so much better now at making use of possession. I think the one stat that I highlight, I think it's average sequences, so which is, you know, I think it's 10 plus passes that end up resulting in a shot compared to just the amount of time that they have on the ball. And they average about 10.2 seconds per passing sequence. And it's the same under Parker as it is under Silva now, but just they create about 4 shots from those passing moves compared to 3 per game, which is a massive difference. And then you can see the attacking numbers, just how they roll off the back of it. And Fulham just are a more well-rounded team. We talked about set pieces. They can score from set pieces. They didn't really do that under Parker as much as there was a playoff final. Success was on it. They didn't do this to the same extent, not even close. And then defensively as well, which you just wouldn't expect when you see the numbers that the Fulham are putting in. We saw the run of 5 clean sheets. Now, of course, there are caveats. You know, we are halfway through the season. This squad is better than the one Parker had 2 years ago. I don't think that's not really debatable, but there is quite clearly a step up. And it's, as we were mentioning before, there are players in that squad who are playing at levels they haven't done before. And I think that's quite telling in terms of what output Marco Silva's getting from them. Mitrovic, Jean-Michel Seri at Fulham, in any case. Naiskens Cabano, Tim Ream's playing at a very good standard as well. I didn't mention him so much in the piece, but he is. There are a lot of players he's getting a lot more out of. And that's what's really so striking about the difference.
Yeah, and just looking ahead from a Fulham team point of view for Friday, Jack, what lineup? We assume that everyone we know is fit. I'm going to guess that it's Chalobah, Cavallero, Stansfield, who are still out, and we don't exactly know what state we are with the illnesses, but again, you'd think it's illness. We're a week on, they've had 6 days. Most people are probably going to be recovered that need to be. What changes, if any, would you like to see Fulham go with on Friday night?
Look, I know we spoke at the start of the podcast about the fact that we didn't want, well, not didn't want, but we're a little bit surprised at the lack of rotation, given there was a midweek game and given that there were injuries, et cetera, et cetera, et cetera. So yes, I think there are changes. I'd like to see Kenny Tete come back in. And I'd probably like to see Bobby Reid come back in, although I'm not quite sure for who, because I think that Fabio has been very impressive the last couple of games. Don't think Harrison Reid's been brilliant. For a couple of games now, has struggled a little bit, but I'm not sure if you can risk playing a kind of pivot of, well, Bobby Reid and John McHale Seri, if it's just a little bit risky, given this is a very good side. So I think Tete will come back in. I think that's something that we can assume is relatively close, even though I thought Dennis did all right, to be honest. Right back, I've been critical at some points this season of his performances. I thought he was okay at Preston. But yeah, I would like to see Bobby Reid back in. I think he's been really impressive this season. And just obviously that versatility is useful off the bench, but also I just think he provides a real thrust and drive to this team. So I think maybe Bobby for Fabio and Tete for Adoy would be my two changes, perhaps.
That's a big call on Bobby. Peter, your thoughts on the lineup and what Fulham need to do to get the result?
I share Jack's difficulty in making changes, and I think you're right. I mean, the rotation thing on Preston, I think that applies to that game, but I don't think it applies here in terms of the rest. I thought Dennis Adoy did quite well, and I actually thought he was probably the best performer in that back line at Preston. I mean, it wasn't the best performance. Yeah. Obviously, Tim Ream scored, but I thought Adoy was pretty consistent in that game, and you can see why he's been able to sort of keep his place. But yeah, if you're going to make a change, maybe Kenny Tete back in, as Jack said. Midfield is so difficult. It comes down to that question of do you allow for, does Bobby Decadova-Reed provide the same bite that Reed will do around Seri? And Silva's talked already about how Seri does need someone who can do that sort of biting, whether that's Reed or Chalobah, who fit that sort of profile. I probably would only make one change, I think. And it would probably be a reluctant one if it's Dennis, because I think Dennis has done okay. So yeah, we talked about rotation. You complained about rotation before, but for this one, yeah, it's for such a big game, I would probably play the team that's kept Fulham unbeaten, really.
Yeah, that would be for me as well. As much as I agonise over Bobby Decadova-Reed, I really do. I feel like it's the most harsh dropping of the season, because he was absolutely fantastic in so many of our massive games. But you've then got Fabio Carvalho back and all of his talents. I can't be dropping him. I just cannot. In this game, he will thrive under the pressure and the big lights. He seems to rise to the occasion. And I would go with Carvalho. But if it was Decadova-Reed, I would also be like absolutely fine. And yeah, Tete for Adoy also seems like a fairly inevitable change. But yeah, otherwise, for me, It'd be Rodak, Robinson, Ream, Tosin and Tete at the back. The pivot of Seri and Reed. You need Reed in this game. You can't put Seri and Kearney, I don't think, in this. But look, you could bring on Kearney if we were in a good position going into the second half. I wouldn't be opposed to that. I would have Cabano, Carvalho, Wilson, but I would bring on Decadova Reed if there is really any issue. Like either you're chasing a goal or... Even if we're looking to kind of protect things, I think that Bobby Decadova Reed is a fantastic option off the bench. And then obviously Mr. Mitro up top, who is going to want to score 7 goals in this game if he absolutely can, because he would love nothing more. I mean, Jack, do we think if Mitro scores, we might see an Adebayor running to the other end past Parker, hand to his ear?
I probably hope so. Yeah, no, probably not. He'll probably just get the Mitrovic celebration and he'll give it large to the fans, won't he? So that'd be nice.
Beautiful.
Yeah, I mean, look, it'd be great. It'd be funny, but probably not, no.
All right, well, it's a huge game. 7:45 on Friday. It's on Sky if you can't make the match. The match is sold out. The tickets are going like hotcakes. The Twitter black market is up and running for this game. And I've got to give a huge shout out to people on Twitter. I put a little tweet out the other week saying that I was looking for an aisle seat to take my dad to this game because he's just had knee surgery. I must have had about like half a dozen people tweet me within minutes offering seats and stuff. I just felt really like humbled by that because it was really lovely that people were actually trying their best to kind of help my dad and I out in that situation. So fortunately we've managed to sort it. A lovely guy called Dave got in touch and we've got it solved. But I just wanted to say thank you so much. It was a really, really nice moment for so many people to get in touch. And even if people couldn't help, they shared it, etc. So thank you for that. Anyway, we're going to take a break afterwards. Got some emails. Part 3 of the Fulhamish podcast, Sammy James with Peter Rutzler and Jack Collins. So in the last kind of month or so, I've been saving up your emails for the Thursday pod. And naturally, this means that we're now getting a lot more emails. hello@fulhamish.co.uk if you want to send me an email. I don't always reply to them on the email, but I put them in a little Word document and I save them up for the Thursday podcast. This first one is for Tim Clark, who actually is part of the Fulhamish writing team, for my new section, which I'm going to call This'll Catch On. And it's, we seem to have weekly suggestions of chants to us. I don't know, we have no control whether chants get sung or not, but I'm happy to kind of read them and I'll rate them as to the likelihood of this catching on. This one was, I'm going to put this out there, but if people are after a song for Marco Silva, surely Maxwell's Silver Hammer by the Beatles would work pretty well. No, maybe no one actually cares, but the phrasing works pretty seamlessly. Easy to sing, well known, etc. Jack, I'm going to counter the well known. I know a few Beatles songs. I'd like to think I know maybe more than average. This one, no, never heard of it.
It was like pretty well known. I was like, I'm not 100% sure I'm with you though. I have heard the song, but well known would be a statement that I would not stand by, I'm afraid. Someone's been watching Get Back, which is what I can tell you about this. Someone's been watching Get Back and therefore has seen what's going on in these on the B-sides. But yeah, it's I mean, look, it's a good shout, but it's not going to.
It's a 2 out of 10 for me. It's not going to catch on, but it's a great chant. But this is all called This'll Catch On. I'm giving people the likelihood of whether it will catch on. So Tim, thank you for your suggestion. Keep the chant suggestions coming in and I will happily rate them or slate them. Just be prepared. Next one from David Smith says, hi team. I was naturally inclined to support Coventry against Bournemouth last weekend as Bournemouth are our nearest rivals, as well as the obvious Scott Parker factor. I saw you had the same approach. However, is it actually more important that the teams behind the top two don't catch up? Apart from bragging rights, are there any real benefits for finishing the season in first rather than second? E.g., how much money is at stake? Or is the only thing that matters making sure we finish in the automatic spots? Thank you, David. Peter, your thoughts on David's suggestion?
I don't know the specifics of the finances, but I think it pales in comparison to what it means to be in the Premier League in terms of television rights for going up. So in that sense, not really that relevant. I think it's a fair point. I think the most important gap is not first to second, it's first to third. Fundamentally, the job is to go up. So, yeah, I can see that. But at the same time, going up is one thing, winning the league is another. And I think, you know, considering the way Fulham are playing, you'd like a crown, you'd like it to be crowned in some way. And it would be all the sweeter if it's pipping Bournemouth.
Yeah. For me, it's like, what's the point of winning anything? You know, if it just boils down to money, no, it doesn't really matter. First versus
it's
second.
It's a trophy. It's a title, isn't it? How often do you win the title?
Yeah, it's the second division. We haven't won a trophy, apart from the Intertoto, I'm sorry, in 21 years since the championship. That's our last actual trophy. The playoff is not a trophy. It kind of is, but it's not really. So it's a chance at
winning
something.
Can we win the
something.
Traditions Cup one summer? The Cup of Traditions?
Probably. We probably won an Asian Cup or something in 2006.
Pretty sure
as
we
well,
won the Cup of Traditions once. With it though. I think this is, I think the point is absolutely spot on, isn't it? Like, yes, there's like love of it, and yes, there's it, but Fulham need to go up automatically. And that is the truth. And look, I think the kind of reaction that we're getting, et cetera, is because of the way that Fulham dropped points and then obviously Bournemouth dropped points. So there's obviously that like feel of this is more important, right? Because at that exact moment, if you looked at that game in complete isolation, you'd be probably looking at it and going, it doesn't really matter what happens here in terms of, but just because Fulham had already dropped points, it felt massive that Bournemouth then didn't leapfrog Fulham. And actually, I think, Sammy, you were saying this last week, that we really want to be ahead of Bournemouth when Fulham played them, because otherwise sit in, play for the draw. You could have come to the Cottage. I imagine, look, we've talked about lots of teams coming to the Cottage and playing for the draw. And I'd imagine that if you offered Scott Parker a point now, he'd say, thanks very much, I'll take it. But even more so if they were already above us, right? Yeah. That even more so because it keeps their position on top. It holds their form, like all of the above. So I think there is now a kind of, there is an extra element, an extra incentive for them to come out and try and play a little bit more to try and get back to the top of the table, which should suit Fulham because we tend to do better against teams who want to actually have a go. So maybe there's that kind of element to it too.
The next one from Tim Miller at Londinium Calling on Twitter. He said, I know he had a poor game at Preston, but according to Bill Edgar, the Times' football stats man, Mitrovic's goal per minute ratio at international level, excluding penalties, is the second highest in Europe in the last 50 years, behind Lukaku, but ahead of Ronaldo. In view of this eye-watering statistic, would you agree that the debate as to whether Mitro can cut it in the top level is over and Scott Parker can be catapulted into the Fulham Hall of Shame alongside Laurie Sanchez and Felix Magath? Mitro may not have matched Fulham's style of play in the Premier League, but that's only because under Parker, our style was not to score any goals. I love it.
It's like the exact opposite email from the one we got a couple of weeks ago about criticizing Parker too much. It's like the exact opposite. So look, yeah, in many ways, well, look, Mitrovic scored double figures the last time Fulham were in the Premier League, not under Scott Parker, right? In another relegation season. I don't think the argument holds weight that he's not good enough to do it in the Premier League. Last year, he didn't score because he didn't get any games. And when he scored at international level, when he scored at championship level, when he scored pretty much everywhere he's been, he's done it. So, I mean, I agree in that I don't think that the argument carries any weight. I just think it's a question of stylistic natures, and look, you can't blame some strikers don't work for certain players. And you can talk about Pep Guardiola not liking Zlatan Ibrahimovic. It doesn't make Zlatan Ibrahimovic a bad footballer. And it doesn't make Pep Guardiola a bad coach. Those two things are just sometimes just not compatible. And it clearly didn't work between Parker and Mitrovic. And that's where we're at with it. And I don't think that debate needs much more weight to it. I'm pretty comfortable with the suggestion that Mitrovic can do it wherever he's given service.
Yeah. I completely agree. Like, it's just, I mean, it's... Jack said it. We don't want to give it too much more discussion, but you can't make an assessment of Mitrovic in the top flight. He hasn't had the circumstances. But I just, maybe we'll see next year. Hopefully we will. In terms of Hall of Shame, that's everyone's own decision, I suppose.
Yeah, I think to compare him to Sanchez and Felix Magath is strong. Neither of them won at a playoff final at Wembley against Brentford. But, you know, each to your own. If you want to stick them in the room 101 of Fulham managers, then be my guest. Mark in California, I also emails on this point. He says, hello to the three of you. Sammy, I request these two questions to be read on your Thursday show because I really trust your judgment. But I'm going to just go for question two, where he says, personally, I am done with the question. Can Mitro play in the Premier League? There is a certain lounge on the grounds named after one Brian McBride. And whilst I believe McBride was probably a quicker player, his game really mirrored Mitro and he did just fine in the Prem. Basically, I think he's saying that Mitro deserves a lounge. And Nothing could be more true.
That was actually quite a long time ago, though. I will caveat that with this. Like, you know, we've seen eras of different type of players change across the years. McBride's era was a lot more physical, a lot more crosses whipped into the box. As you know, we were seeing a lot more aerial things won. So there is that element of it. I'm not to disagree with the point. I think that Mitrovic can't hit the Premier League, but I would just slightly caveat that Brian McBride played in a different era to what Alexander Mitrovic is playing in now.
Yeah. Jack, I know you've seen this email. It was very directed at me.
It's good vibes. I enjoyed it a lot.
From Matt Littlejohn, it was basically, the title of the email was, "Sammy, I want to hear your opinion on this." I was like, okay, what's this? He first of all says that he's a huge fan of Fulhamish. He lives in Washington, D.C., and he depends on the pod and The Athletic, as he knows no other Fulham fans here. His wife and kids are perplexed at his sudden accidental devotion to the Whites and why he's suddenly laughing when listening to the pod and yelling at the TV early on Saturday mornings. He said, "Sammy, here's my question. Why do you think Joe Bryant should start over Anthony Robinson? Can you say why in terms of numbers, offence, defence, etc.? I am no surprise a US men's national team fan and on Team Jedi, and I am perplexed and worried by the increasing amount of hate Anthony Robinson is getting from the fan base. As far as I can tell, the argument is that Joe is a better crosser, which I think is probably correct. To me, the thing is that Anthony sends in a ton more crosses because he's faster and stronger and also frees up the Cabano with his overlapping runs, whereas Joe never gets upfield and sends in about one cross a game. And Joe is worse in defence and in the air, other than maybe one-on-one coverage where he is kind of all square. What am I missing? Thanks, Sammy."
Well, I mean, he's got a point.
I mean, it's the. I feel like it was the grilling of Sammy James. I was reading my own death note there. I just say that I've been frustrated with Robinson's passing and some of his technical ability in the last few games. I see why Anthony Robinson plays, and I can definitely agree with you that he does free up Cabano. I would argue that it's not just because Anthony Robinson puts more crosses into the box. I just think that Joe Bryan, as an attacking outlet, is fantastic, and his relationship with Micho was brilliant. But I also do see that A, Anthony Robinson's defending generally is better than Joe's. And also, if we're going to go up next season, that Anthony Robinson would be better for us in the Premier League, where we're going to have to do a lot more defending, and Robinson's pace will be absolutely crucial to our style of play. So I don't know if I ever fully said I am 100% Team Joe, but I will take the point on the chin. Thank you. And my dressing down has been served.
I just think there's a fair point to be made here, in that whilst I love Joe Bryan, like to bits, and I will always be grateful to him. And to be honest, I reckon he should probably get a statue up. You know, we can discuss the ins and outs of what it is. But ultimately, I think the question is, who do I want to start more games? The answer to that question is Anthony Robinson. But I want to see a bit more rotation. And that's what I struggle with, right? That it's not that I think that Joe Bryan should be starting every game. And to be honest, when there's a week break here, I wouldn't change the left backs. I wouldn't switch it around for this next game coming up. I think that Robinson's defensive work rate is excellent. I think that his pace getting forward allows us to stretch the pitch more. I think he play a little bit wider when he's in the team, and I think that helps us. But I do think that there is also space to rotate a left back, because we have two very competent left backs in this division who are, you know, almost any other team in the division would be starting both of. And I think, just given that fact, we could probably do with a little bit more rotation, just because you don't want to see someone like Robinson burn out. And I think that's what we have seen a little bit of in the times before. And, you know, his pace and that ability to drive forward and get at people is a massive asset for Fulham, but not if you use it all up, right? You have to keep him fit. You have to keep him healthy. You have to keep him in, you know, the form that he wants to be in. And I think you can do that by rotating a little bit more. That's all I would probably say on it.
I think Jack's point is spot on, because this is sort of a debate that sort of emerged and gets quite fierce, when I think it's actually a little bit more nuanced. And as Jack says, it's just a case of, yeah, I think Anthony Robinson should be first choice. I think there's a ceiling there. You can see how he, as the listener said, you know, in terms of how he helps Niskanen Cabana on that left hand side, provides width, he's got pace, his crossing's got better as well. I think that's worth acknowledging too. But there are moments where you just want Joe Bryan to play. I think post Blackpool we got a spike, and post Preston we'll get a spike in that sentiment, because both occasions, Robinson, well, first time was come back from international duty. This time, you know, he come out and Silver said he's been ill. There's a three-day turnaround. And again, there's a scope for rotation. And you just, the question is, why? Why is Joe Bryan not playing? And I guess that's one for me to ask Marco Silva, I suppose.
Yeah, I have been perplexed why Joe Bryan hasn't been used more this season. It did feel like, though, Joe Bryan did kind of start getting a bit of a run. I think it might have been the Swansea game where he started and then got injured, and that was unfortunate for Joe, because just as I think he'd maybe started to worm his way back into Silva's plans. It? Potentially.
Remember, he slid into the post?
Yes, sorry. I knew he'd got injured against someone, so yeah. That was maybe the moment where Joe's season maybe slipped away. But it seemed perplexing to me that he wasn't using either of the recent two games, particularly with Anthony Robinson ill. Maybe Joe Bryan was iller and just Marcus Silva never told us. But
that is also possible.
We'll never know. Matt also gave the story of how he became a Fulham fan, which was very interesting. Long story short, he went to go both watch Chelsea and Fulham on a time that he came over from the States, because he knew some Chelsea fans, but he also went to a Fulham game. He came back thinking he was a Chelsea fan, and then slowly over the years he seemed to learn the error of his ways, and he just said that he related more to Fulham. He said they're long-suffering, self-deprecating, funny, loyal, optimistic, and ready to enjoy the moment. I really did not want to become a fan, but I did. My friend Michael is thrilled because, as he said, Fulham are a proper English football team, and because it means I'm not a Chelsea fan. So well done for learning the error of your ways, and I'm sorry that I dared to slate Anthony Robinson. The final one is a guy called Michael has sent me a horn for the next time that I'm allowed to use it. He sent me the horn that they use at the 49ers match whenever they score a touchdown at home. I've listened to the horn. It's a fantastic horn, and I will use it the next time that I'm allowed to play the horn. I was going to ask this, Jack, am I allowed to play the horn on the weekend if we beat Bournemouth?
If we beat Bournemouth by more than one goal, I think.
Yeah?
I think that's it. I think it's if you get like a 2-0, 3-0, you know, that's what it feels like to me.
Yeah, I mean, come
I don't
on,
know, maybe I'm wrong.
I think, you know, if it's 10 unbeaten, you've beaten Bournemouth, there's a 4-point gap to second. That's probably horn-worthy territory, isn't it?
Fine.
Probably okay, in the conversation, but I think it needs to be two or more goals. I think it needs to be relatively convincing. Or like a last-minute winner. You know, it needs to be either dramatic or convincing.
Okay. Them the rules. I will abide by them. We've been kind of adapting the horn rule as we go out throughout the season. So thank you very much for that. And thank you very much for listening today. That is the end of the podcast. A bit of a rambly one. Thank you so much for your emails. Please do send in more. hello@fulhamish.co.uk. Really enjoying this last bit of the show where we read some of your wonderful letters and correspondence. It's great for us to have. It really brightens up our week as well when we get some of the emails through. Just kind of popping through just for us to just amuse ourselves on the train or whatever we're doing in our day. So thank you so much for that. Jack Collins, thank you very much for being on the pod today.
Thank you, Sammy. I cannot wait to hear Maxwell's silver hammer being wrung out from the Hammersmith end this weekend.
I know. It's going to put me to shame when everyone in the back of the hammy end really, you know, goes to town just to prove me wrong that that's no way going to catch on. And Peter, enjoy the Rutsler derby.
I will savour it. I'll savour every moment. I'll sit there and I'll get there 2 hours before kickoff and just sit there and just soak it all in.
I tell you what, we can start if we're up 3-0 at 70 minutes is Peter Rutsler. He left because you're shit.
Oh my God. I'll be singing it. It might just be me, but I'll be there at the back of H4 with my dad in crutches singing it large to the whole of the stadium. All right. Thank you very much for listening. I'll be back on Sunday reviewing the Bournemouth game, whatever happens, hopefully with 3 points in the bag and an important win for the Whites. But until then, have a great weekend and up the Whites on Friday.
You Whites.